This is the Takeaway Podcast for Friday, July 22nd, 2016.
This is the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. It was time for the candidate to make his best case last night.
My opponent asks her supporters to recite a three-word loyalty pledge. It reads, I'm with her. I choose to recite a different pledge. My pledge reads, I'm with you, the American people.
Donald Trump closed out his own show in Cleveland with a measured and comprehensive, some might say endless, speech full of humility and hyperbole.
It is time to show the whole world that America is back, bigger and better and stronger than ever before.
Does this convention, does that speech, does the performance by the candidate set the stage finally for the GOP between now and November? Todd Zwillick was there to witness it all in Cleveland. Todd, did Trump deliver, and what did he have to deliver last night?
Well, John, Trump delivered an on-script speech, something that everybody thought that he had to. He didn't go off script. He wasn't impulsive. He gave voters the more presidential version of a lot of the things he's been saying over the campaign, and he delivered his attack on Hillary Clinton. But, John, I have some scenes from the Republican convention after it was all over last night, after the balloons were dropped at the Q Center and it empties out. What do? You go to the bars. And that's what I did, along with Takeaway producer Amber Hall. We decided to go where Donald Trump's home delegation, the New York delegation, was celebrating. And boy, were they celebrating. I caught up with Bob Haysen. He's a delegate and a party official from the Finger Lakes region in upstate New York. He was carrying a Trump flag right around the bar.
This is the time of my life, and I'm exhausted, and I'm still going on with adrenaline. It was a great day.
You having some drinks tonight?
They don't count on the drinks don't count on the adrenaline of being so high, really. I mean, Donald Trump made a lot of believers out of the naysayers tonight.
John, Donald Trump maybe did make some believers last night, but now what's in front of him? Hillary Clinton, well-funded, organized, and at the head of a party that, for all its divisions, is probably more cohesive than the divided GOP of this week. Danny Esquilin is the GOP vice chairman in Brooklyn, and I asked him about the formidable Hillary Clinton.
She's not easy to beat.
Yeah, we know that, but we're building coalitions. Coalitions of the Asians, of the Orthodox Jews, of Italians, of Irish. All over the state of New York, we're going to hurt her. What else? There's nothing else to do.
Sounds a little alarming there, Todd. I suspect the Republican New York delegation hasn't had this much attention in, six decades.
No, and to be honest, they probably haven't had that many drinks in a couple of decades either. John, I wanted to close out the GOP convention with a story. It's the story of the Dayglow Revolution. Last night, I caught up with a pro-Cruz delegate named Bill Eastland. He's from Arlington. He was passing out Dayglow green hats to his delegation on the floor. He had a whole box of them. Turns out they were originally meant for an anti-Trump or anti-RNC floor fight back at the beginning of this week when the revolt was still possible. Now they're basically useless souvenirs.
Yeah, basically, they were sort of the uniforms of the revolution. The question is which part of the revolution? It's hard to tell. The problem was the revolution was divided. It had different generals. They occasionally brought the colonels into the tent, never brought the majors, captains, and lieutenants. And so, therefore, the revolution failed.
John, I asked Bill Eastland, though, why the Dayglow green?
There was a little bit of, purpose in that.
Tell me.
Confusion creates confusion.
How does it do that?
Because they're the same color as the Trump floor manager hats. Think about it. You put a lot of hats on other people, and people don't know who the Trump people are and who the non-Trump people are.
Ooh, that's pretty tricky there, Todd.
Bill Eastland actually called it a dirty trick himself. But Bill Eastland also said that revolution, of course, it never happened. But the Ted Cruz story isn't done. After all the confrontation this week, John, Ted Cruz sits out the rest of the election, of course, but he waits to see if Donald Trump loses in November. Next door to Texas on the floor was the Colorado delegation, and they were actually brooding a little bit last night. They're strongly for Ted Cruz. And Delegate Lori Sain says that her party is divided and that right now is advantage Democrats.
I think the Democratic Party has always had a little bit more of a cohesive message anyway versus the Republican Party. And we've seen the schism the Republican Party building for some time. So I don't think this convention represents anything different that's going on in the states right now. And Colorado is a battleground state. And if Mr. Trump can't win Colorado on this floor, he's going to have a hard time doing it out on the campaign battlefield.
John, Lori Sain has a long view. She said that conservatism for her is more important than one election, and maybe it might be a good object lesson for the GOP if Donald Trump loses to Hillary Clinton in November. And other conservatives are looking beyond the convention, too. Bill Eastland, the man with the hats from the defunct Dayglow Revolution, says that after he goes home and sleeps it off, the fight goes on, Trump or no Trump.
We must continue to fight for our principles in the conservative movement, within the Republican Party, so that eventually we can win. That's what this is all about. I am a committed warrior in that fight. I have been there for a long time.
So the revolution?
The revolution continues. The revolution is not going to end until we win or we get thoroughly defeated and we become slaves. Spartacus.
Well, there is a revolution. If Trump should win, and that's a big hypothetical at this point, it would completely decimate the Ted Cruz conservatives within the Republican Party. That would be a revolution right there.
Well, it would certainly prove that Ted Cruz's gambit of not endorsing Donald Trump and the dreams of Bill Eastland and the Spartacus slaves of the RNC have failed, John. We'll see you Monday in Philadelphia at the Democratic National Convention. It's Hillary's turn.
Great stuff, Todd. See you in Philly.
Thanks, John.
Friends, delegates, and fellow Americans, I humbly and gratefully accept your nomination for the presidency of the United States. Are you ready to elect the next president of these United States?
Donald Trump will build the wall.
Do you want to help make America one again?
All lies!
Those three greatest threats are Osama, Obama, and your mama.
I feel like the anchovy on Ivanka's Caesar salad.
What the hell's going on out here? In this race for the White House, I am the law and order candidate.
Can polls tell us anything that this unlikely Trump candidacy hasn't already defied? You could shoot a documentary with all the high-profile pollsters and political analysts who have at some point counted Trump out. What kind of a convention bump might Trump get, and is it in the places where he really needs support? Harry Enten is senior political writer and analyst for 538. He was a Trump skeptic, not so much anymore. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick and Enten found a few minutes to crunch numbers and play out some plausible Trump scenarios for November.
Well, I mean, some of the polls, in fact, are looking kinder to him. I mean, he clearly is trailing in this race at this point, but we have seen some tightening of the race. For instance, the 538 polls only forecast has Trump at nearly a 40% chance of winning the general election. Again, Hillary Clinton has a greater chance than Donald Trump has, but his odds have been moving up. When we started our model less than a month ago, he was a 3-1 underdog, and now it's much closer to 3-2. So I think Trump does have a chance of winning, but again, Hillary Clinton is the favorite.
Do we expect after Hillary's convention, after President Obama starts to campaign heavily for her, after she has a VP pick, for those numbers to normalize a bit or to spread back out? Or?
Well, I don't know. I mean, traditionally speaking, convention bounces can happen or not happen. Usually they do occur, but we don't know necessarily who's going to get the larger convention bounce. We do know that convention bounces do matter. After the convention, we get a much better idea of who's going to win the general election campaign. If Hillary Clinton does, in fact, widen her lead and say the 5 percentage points in the national polls, then have the conventions behind us, then she is probably going to win. Right now in the national polls, We have her average lead a little less than 3 percentage points. So we'll wait and see. But right now, you know, you're looking at the RNC. You have to think that the DNC can't go any worse than the RNC's gone so far.
So let's talk about the demographic picture, because you look at polls of certain demographic groups. Latinos stands out especially. People know the number where Donald Trump has approximately 14 or 15% support among Latinos. It's an abysmal number. When Mitt Romney lost Latinos by 38 points, that prompted the autopsy, the Republican Party saying we have to get right with the broader range of voters. Donald Trump has done the opposite. So what does the pathway demographically look like for him? Where does he have to win?
I mean, essentially, his whole idea is win and win big with whites without a college degree. That is the type of voter that he appealed to in the primary. If you look at how he's doing among whites without a college degree, he's doing better than Mitt Romney was doing 4 years ago. The problem is they are a shrinking part of the American electorate, and we're not quite sure whether or not he can win them by a wide enough margin in order to offset his losses among Latinos and his losses, or at least doing worse than Mitt Romney did, among whites with a college degree.
And how many whites without a college degree are there? Percentage-wise, how many does he need? How big of a group is this?
I mean, it really does depend, depending on how he does with the other groups. And again, we have different surveys which indicate different things of how much of the electorate they are. They're probably somewhere, I would say, about 35% of the electorate. 35 to 40%, again, depending on which measures you exactly look at. He probably needs to win them by at least 30 percentage points, perhaps even more, depending on how poorly he does with whites with a college degree and Latino voters.
But breaking down the polls that you know about in the swing states, or even demographically in these swing states, how are they shaking out? National polls are good to talk about. They tell you a lot less than the swing state polls.
Sure. I mean, the swing state polls essentially tell us what the national poll demographics are telling us, which is Donald Trump is doing decently well in the state of Ohio. He's still probably trailing there at this point. There was a Suffolk poll that recently came out, which actually had the race tied when it was a one-on-one with Clinton, but then Trump fell back a few points when you included Jill Stein and Gary Johnson in the question. But it's a close race in Ohio. I think the real question of this election is whether Donald Trump can break through in a state like Pennsylvania. Can he break through? This is a state that Republicans, at least some Republicans, have argued that there are a lot of voters in the middle of the state and the southwestern part of the state, these places that actually have been Democratic for a long time, but these more cultural conservatives, whites without a college degree. Can Trump break through enough with them to offset his losses, say, in the southeastern part of the state, in the Philadelphia suburbs, among whites with a college degree? If Donald Trump can carry Pennsylvania, which at this point we're not expecting him to do, but if he can do it, he has changed the electoral map, he has broken through, and he could be on his way to the White House.
Harry Enten, thank you for joining us. Harry Enten is senior political writer and analyst at 538.
Thank you.
The Republican Party claims to be one happy family following the convention, but there's Senator Queeg, Ted Cruz, on the sidelines, darkly rooting for a Trump defeat. But there are the more numerous happy, loyal Trump kids insisting there is nothing not to like about their dad. Tell us about a serious divide with a family or friend. Were you able to unify and come together?
Hi, this is Karen Dewey calling from New Hampshire. Yes, I did have a serious divide with a friend. It was over loyalty and honesty. Over time, it repaired, and recently it happened again with the same person. Sadly, I will not open myself to this disappointment again. So in the future, this friend will be at an arm's length.
Tell us your breakup or makeup story. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. There's always more at thetakeaway.org. This is The Takeaway.
I'm like, I still got my hands in the air. I say, no, I just got shot. And I'm standing there, I'm like, sir, why did you shoot me? And his words to me, he said, I don't know.
Charles Kinsey is lucky to be alive, speaking there from a North Miami hospital. A cop inexplicably shot him while he was trying to recover a mentally ill patient who had escaped from an independent living facility. Now, Kinsey joins the roll call of black men shot by white officers. In this case, at least, there is an explicit acknowledgement in the officer saying, I don't know, that there was no reason for that officer to have fired his gun. And yet he did, hitting Kinsey in the leg. There were reports of a weapon on the scene, but none was found. There goes another one. A glance at the headlines. What's it going to be now? Don't look at them. Just turn off the television. And you still wonder, in this summer of 16, what's next? Is there a valid escape, a pause of some kind, to find a bubble where things like this don't happen? Ambassador Dr. Susan Johnson Cook is a preacher, former NYPD chaplain, a former ambassador for international religious freedom under President Obama. She says we all need to find some kind of solace to retrieve our strength and find the common ground to roll up our sleeves and eventually solve these problems in our communities.
For me, I bring faith leadership into the conversation, and I think that's what's been one of the missing pieces, because we are on the edge, nationally, locally, and internationally. I mean, my position actually was really going into religious war zones and seeing that was the beginning of ISIS, you know, really our hearing about it and the beginning of the Boko Haram, and it's escalated to proportions we can't seem to control.
So you can find that solace even if you're that close to the violence.
Yes, I can. And you have to. I think that that's what makes the human spirit work, that you have to find the solace, not just in that one particular instance, but you have to find it often. So it's how you prepare to go into a situation. It's what you do after you come out of a situation. I was on the front lines of 9/11. New York City Police Department chaplain, had been 20-some years into the ministry, very well trained. We had not been trained for post-traumatic stress or trauma, period. And here I was on the front lines with the smoke and the fire still happening. And firefighters who had been up all night trying to find their brethren and police officers trying to find their brothers and sisters. And I remember pulling over to the side of the highway and having to just stop in the midst of all of that and just have my cry, because I had to get it back together for me so that I could be in a position to help others.
How should people who follow events, who maybe get very full of anxiety about what's going on in the world and feel so powerless, how can they step back from the emotional toll of events without losing the idea that I need to do something here?
That's a great question. You know, as you said, you have to step back. And so that in the midst of what's going on, whatever your place is, how you get into your zone, you have to stop, drop, and pray. Not feel that you are the responsible one or the fixer. Because when you go into a situation and you're not prepared and it's not your assignment, then that's chaos.
In these police shootings where people have a sense that somehow they are involved in the racial narrative, white or black, they have a role that maybe they don't want. How are we in that situation to step up without stepping away and escaping?
The events happening now, many of them with racial overtones, didn't just start. You know, so for this generation, many are just seeing it. I'm a mother of two African-American men, 21 and 24. We have what we call the talk, the prayer, and the cry. So when I was growing up, the talk meant you were going to have this talk about the birds and the bees. Now it's with your sons. This is what you're going to do if you're stopped. This is how you're going to carry yourself. This is how you're going to enter and exit stores and buildings and public places. And this is how you're going to carry yourself as an African-American man. Understand, though, you can be stopped while black, driving while black, living while black. Understand that. So that's the talk. The prayer is every time they leave my home, whether that's to go to school or to go out, I do the prayer. You know, God, I pray that my children will come back home and safely. And then it's the cry, because there is a moment that a mother gets the call. My oldest son was like, Ma, I was driving down a single lane highway, the same speed as everyone else. There was no other place to go, no place to go slower, faster, and I'm stopped. So that's the cry. These events didn't just happen, so we have to approach them in many respects. It's not wrong for people to emote. It is wrong for people to disrespect authority. It is wrong for authority to disproportionately disrespect and imprison brown and black men. So I think we have to get it in perspective, and there has to be leadership.
The way race manifests itself in the United States, it is a constant experience for African Americans. It appears to be an episodic experience for whites in the sense that they understand that there's diversity, but they aren't as deeply entered in the experience in the form of vigilance that you describe with the call and the prayer. And I think whites are discovering for good or ill, that their awareness of this needs to be dialed up. And they're entering into an experience that is unfamiliar, maybe fills them with a certain amount of anxiety. Am I responsible? Am I not responsible? How do I be responsible here in this experience that I'm entering, which is consciousness of privilege, understanding that that privilege may have had consequences even to my friends? How does that very different experience mix?
Well, the two things noted. When I speak, I say we as blacks. When you speak, you say they as whites. And that's a very interesting thing. But it is episodic because there's so much happening right now in the news. But racism is not new. I mean, it happens on every level. I think if it takes these episodes to get the conversation going, sadly, then that's what has to happen.
Looking at all of these problems that mm-hmm. we're experiencing in the world mm-hmm. right now, are people to be faulted for wanting to get away from it all?
Well, not at all. I think that's healthy. People are very right to have a time of solace. And communities also need a time of solace because we know we've got to gear up for some of the things that are happening.
Step back, pause, and strengthen yourself mm-hmm. for the hard work ahead.
Strengthen yourself for the struggle. You have to have those moments.
Does Obama do that?
He does.
In a good way? Is it tough for him?
I mean, when you're leading a nation and you're the most powerful leader in the world, it's probably tough. But, you know, the thing about solace is you take it without permission.
Well, Ambassador Dr. Susan Johnson-Cook, thank you very much.
It was my pleasure.
You've certainly given us some tools to find our various solaces.
And thank you for having this wonderful interview. I really enjoyed it. I feel really at peace.
All right. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Dr. Susan Johnson-Cook is a former ambassador for international religious freedom, founder of the Pro-Voice, Pro-Vaz movement for women. It was the otherworldly voice from Jimi Hendrix's guitar that first awakened the musical spirits inside young Eric Krasnow. Krasnow's more subdued skills as a professional guitarist of many musical styles can be heard in the music of the Rolling Stones, Norah Jones, 50 Cent, Talib Kweli, and Aaron Neville. But to bring out something uniquely Krasnow in his new album, he drove a car full of equipment up to Maine and literally nailed together a studio. In the tradition of the band's Big Pink and other great albums recorded on simple vintage equipment far from L.A. or Nashville, Krasnow's Blood from a Stone album is the product of intense collaboration with no distractions. Together, Krasnow and his fellow artists who followed him to Maine create a magic that brings out some new sounds, including Krasnow's own voice, singing for the first time in 20 years. The studio itself became a sanctuary where taking risks was completely natural.
You know, some of us love the process of the album, and, you know, I listen to albums, I listen to vinyl. You know, sure, a lot of people play song by song, but there's still, you know, as a musician, as an artist, having a cohesive piece is still important. I still love, like, album covers and artwork, and I love the whole thing. I know that maybe that's kind of passé now, but it still means something to us. And, you know, it's like rock and roll is so powerful, you know, people, and that's, you know, that a guitar is rock and roll to me, you know. So, you know, it's, and that's, I don't know if that'll ever go away, you know, it's hard to say. But, you know, even with, like, EDM taking over and all that stuff, they're still, implementing elements of rock and roll over and over. It's a cycle that keeps coming back, you know. With this album specifically, you know, I wanted to start playing my own songs and kind of like, go out and represent. This is like the first album where I'm singing lead on the whole thing and, you know, fronting the band in that way. So this album is definitely kind of the embodiment of me kind of like taking that to the stage and kind of, you know, finding a group of songs that really makes sense for me to go out and perform and that I can really, that I'm really saying something with it. Go ahead and breathe the air. When writing for other people, the process is a little bit different because it's kind of like, okay, at least for me, I'm kind of getting inside of someone else's head and then kind of like finding a pathway with them, kind of being like, okay, well, you could say this, you could say that, and this is the kind of vibe. But with this, it was kind of, and I've worked in so many different genres that I did my best to kind of blend that into one thing. Sure, the theme is rock and roll, but, you know, there's elements of soul and Motown in there, and there's elements of jazz in there. And for me, it was kind of like finding a cohesive way to kind of put together all these influences that I love into the songwriting. I didn't necessarily go in with the band into the studio and say, okay, let's run down the track. It was very much experimenting with sounds and ideas and then going in and tracking things. And I played a lot of the instruments on the record and stuff. So there's kind of been two journeys here. And then now it's been great because I'm really excited for the next record, because now that I have this band, this awesome band that's been kind of interpreting these songs in a cool way, and now we've kind of been improvising a bit more with it and trying different things. When mixing this as my first record as a singer, I was probably a little shy when mixing, and I was like, okay, let's make it just a part of the overall palette. So Derek Trucks has been a friend for many years. Soul Live toured with him early that days in 99, 2000. We've been good friends ever since. I've written on a lot of his albums, including the Tedeschi Trucks. So we're good friends. And when I was putting together this track, this is the one instrumental on the record. And it was kind of, you know, as I was writing it, I kind of heard these guitar harmonies and that Allman Brothers-esque. Over a groove that was kind of like a Santana thing. So it's kind of drawing back to the early guitar music that I grew up on, that my dad would play, you know, around the house and stuff. And when we'd kind of lay down the rhythm tracks, I was like, oh man, we got to get Derek to come play on this and we'll do some kind of guitar harmonies. And he was nice enough to let me come down to his studio, and we recorded this down there. Part of like having so much access to music on the internet is that these you know, if you get out and tour and you keep creating content and the music is good, you're going to create big audiences. You know what I mean? If you keep at it and you're creative with what you're doing and you're prolific, you know, so that it's a beautiful thing. There's a lot of new artists that are Anderson .Paak and even Kendrick Lamar and all these guys that are actually like, you know, really pushing things, and they're not really conforming to the pop radio format, but they're getting played and people are respecting what they do. So, you know, in certain ways you can be negative about what's going on, but there's enough good music out there that you know, I'm excited about it. You know, I'm hearing new people all the time impressing me and kind of blowing me away. You know, back in the day, you had to have a record deal. You had to get to a certain point before you made music that people even heard. Now everyone can do that, and it's hard to wade through it a bit, but it allows for, you know, people that would never have the opportunity to get their music out there.
Eric Krasno, guitar player for Soul Live and Lettuce, and now singer on his new album, Blood from a Stone.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. Learn more at TIAA.org. curious.com, working to help people reclaim between 5 and 30 minutes a day to learn something new and build their CQ or curious quotient through the game of lifelong learning. More at curious.com/PRI. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaways Resilience Reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Cleveland, fine. But if culture, zeitgeist, and global reach is your game, you want to be in San Diego, the site of the Comic-Con Mothership Convention, with attendees dressed in elaborate costumes that would never get them past a Secret Service checkpoint in Cleveland. Here, selfies with Captain Kirk or the cast of The Walking Dead are much more important than platform amendments about healthcare or Ukraine. Melissa Locker tells us what's important this year.
Justice League is, it's filming now, but there's a rumor that there's going to be a sneak peek. There's also a bunch of nostalgic stuff coming up. It's the 30th anniversary of Alien. The 20th season of South Park is about to start. And probably the thing that everyone is really, really excited about, which I am also most excited about, is it's the 50th anniversary of Star Trek.
Yeah.
And all of the captains from all the different seasons are coming together for a panel that's going to have, you know, Captain James T. Kirk.
History records that you died saving the Enterprise B from an energy ribbon 80 years ago.
And I'm dead?
Not exactly.
What do people do? They just go there and bask in the just fabulousness of it all?
Yeah, I mean, you have to go in costume. I think a big costume this year might be one of the guys from Guardians of the Galaxy. I think you're going to have people from Batman and Robin, but there's also going to be people from, you know, the Studio Ghibli world with Totoro and No Face usually makes an appearance. There's going to be Doctor Who. There's going to be Star Wars and Star Trek. In the Harry Potter world, the new Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them trailer, it, they think will be debuting at Comic-Con. There's going to be a panel. If you don't know about it, it's worth checking out. It looks pretty exciting. It stars Eddie Redmayne as Newt Scamander, who is traveling to America. The land, which is obviously not the rarefied England.
Just like your suitcase, I think there's much more to you than meets the eye. Kicked out of Hogwarts for endangering human life with a beast. Yet one of your teachers argued strongly against your expulsion. I wonder, what makes Albus Dumbledore so fond of you, Mr. Scamander?
And they have a different name for Muggles, and they have different ways of dealing with magic in general, and it looks pretty amazing.
What about television properties?
There's a lot of TV coming out this year. There's a lot in the comic book world. There's Luke Cage, which was the Jessica Jones spinoff, but so he's in the Marvelverse. He has impenetrable skin, and he's a cool character. There's also, on Saturday is DC Comics Day with the CW TV shows. There's The Flash and Supergirl and Legends of Tomorrow and Arrow all coming together, which has a huge fan base. And then, of course, there's going to be The Walking Dead. The season ended on a massive cliffhanger.
Anybody moves, anybody says anything, cut the boy's other eye out and feed it to his father, and then we'll start. You can breathe. You can blink. You can cry. Hell, you're all going to be doing that.
And people are really excited to see what happens next. And Game of Thrones, the panel, all the cast is getting together. But since the season isn't filming, we're not going to have any sneak peeks or casting news. But there's always nice behind-the-scenes stories and kind of interesting anecdotes. And the cast is really fun.
What would you do if you just had a day to spend at Comic-Con? You'd go here first, there next, and then end up here.
You really want to study the schedule closely. And you want to make sure that you get there early for some of the big panels because they do sell out. They do fill up. People get in line ridiculously early. When the American Gods panel happens, that line is going to be crazy. But then, you know, make sure that you walk through the hall. You see the comic books. You see, like, you can play some of the video games for the first time ever. You can, you know, just see what people are selling, which are going to be really interesting collectibles. And just go and have fun.
How can panels be that interesting? I mean, is it anything other than what you would find on, like, Washington Week in Review?
Yeah, I mean, it's just kind of, you know, the cult of personality. You're going to see these characters and these actors out of costume. It's always sort of amazing. And they're really funny. And when they're unveiling, you know, new trailers or announcing casting news, it's kind of exciting to see it for the first time sitting in the audience. Plus, you're going to be in a crowd with 200 of, you know, the biggest Walking Dead fans you've ever met. If you have even the slightest interest in TV, movies, comics, or video games, you're not going to have a bad time at Comic-Con.
Melissa Locker is a culture reporter for Time, The Guardian, and The Takeaway.
How dare you come into this office and bark at me like some little junkyard dog? I am the President of the United States.
Mr. President.
Mr. President.
Mr. President.
I gave him the presidency.
Who's President of the United States?
I am President Dwayne Elizondo Mountain Dew Herbert Camacho.
Some movie presidents there for Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, the president of all things movies on The Takeaway. Hey, Rafer.
Thank you, John. How are you?
Having a good weekend so far?
So far.
This weekend, the big question gets answered. Star Trek Beyond, can it handle the number three in the installment of the new franchise?
Yeah. I have been a little bit mixed on some of these Star Trek movies, but I really enjoyed this one. A lot of fun. It's like an old-fashioned Star Trek episode. The Enterprise goes out to uncharted space, where else, and they are trying to rescue a ship.
Approaching Ultimate, Class M planet. Massive subterranean development, but limited to no life forms on the surface.
Proximity alert, sir. We have an unknown ship heading right for us.
Lieutenant Uhura hailed them?
Yes, Captain.
So you love?
I really liked it. That's Anton Yelchin there as Chekhov, who passed away. Yeah, very sad. There's also a nod to Leonard Nimoy as well, the original Spock. But what I like about this is there's not a lot of backstory that you have to catch up on. You can really come into this cold and just appreciate it as a standalone story. You get all the great Star Trek interaction between Spock and Bones and Kirk, and they're a lot of fun. Simon Pegg, who plays Scotty, is the
really
lead writer.
Great.
And he's got a comedic touch, and you feel it in this movie, and it's a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it.
All right, moving on to Absolutely Fabulous. Is this the first time this has been a movie?
Yes, indeed.
I want to go in there, but I have to go past that big mirror. I think I am now officially fatter sideways than I am front on, darling.
Darling, you don't need those. I am your mirror.
How do I look?
Fabulous. Thank you.
I can watch this endlessly, endlessly, but as a narrative, how does it hold up?
As a narrative, I will say it's a little on the weak side. This film requires some padding even to reach the 86-minute mark. But that's not really what you're here for. You want to see Jennifer Saunders and Joanna Lumley back together again after 25 years. The show premiered in 92. And that show was so far ahead of its time, before Sex and the City, before Entourage. They're so brilliant together, and it's great to see them back together, even if it feels a little dated and not quite as ahead of the curve as it used to. They're a lot of fun.
But is it absolutely fabulous?
I'm not sure I would say absolutely, but the crowd that I saw with, a mostly gay crowd at the Chelsea, it's got a big gay following that show.
Yeah.
They loved it, and the jokes landed, and it's if you're a diehard fan, I think you're going to appreciate seeing those guys back on screen.
All right, another big release this weekend, Lights Out. What is this about?
Little horror movie about a mentally ill mother played by Maria Bello. Her young son and her daughter start to see the same things she's seeing, which is this malevolent demon that lurks only in the dark. It can only exist in the shadows.
Mom, please let go.
No, listen to me. See, I left her alone for so many years. I abandoned her. But now she's going to stay, okay? As long as I keep my head clear and you keep the lights out.
So Mom's got a little secret friend that kind of turned against her.
Little problem there.
Yeah.
I actually really enjoyed this, too. It's a very...
But did it scare you?
Well, I'm not easily scared in horror films, but what I liked about this was the characters. I think the characters interact really well. I like that central metaphor of mental illness becoming this kind of demon that lurks in the shadows. And I enjoyed it. Short, economical, effective little horror film. I liked it.
How's Gabriel Bateman?
He's good. He plays the kid. He's quite good. So is Teresa Palmer, who plays the older daughter.
Well, we have about 50 seconds. Ice Age. My 6-year-old is going wild for the next Ice Age. Does this happen? Does this work?
I knew you were going to bring that up, John. Yeah. I hate these movies.
I've always hated them.
Do you too?
Oh.
This is... Are you going? Are you going, John?
I have no choice.
It's the worst of the worst.
The worst.
It is absolute nonsense. It's just... they've forgotten all about trying to write a story. It's just one nonsensical joke after another. I don't understand why these prehistoric animals know what social
Same
media
voices.
Is. Same voices.
Dennis
Leary. Ray Romano, Dennis Leary.
Yeah,
it's the bottom of the barrel, finally.
So no clip. No clip for them.
They don't even deserve one.
No. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. Have a great weekend. This is The Takeaway.
Thank you.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.